brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. Really enjoyed putting together that best of in the last episode. And by the way, I hope you guys are enjoying the new year. And yeah, it was good. I mean, I put on there Dan Crenshaw, Andrew Wilkow, Ed Derrick, and now I'm trying to remember all five. But
Mike Vining.
And
Pat McNamara.
Yes, and Pat McNamara, the one that you were on with.
Cool.
So those were our top five of the year out of the top 10 most listened to. I chose five out of those. And yeah, I mean, it's getting a great response. It reminded me, I emailed Dan Crenshaw, who I'm sure is pretty busy. He's being sworn into Congress today. But I was like, you know, I doubt he'll get back to me anytime soon. It'd be great if he does. But I would love to do a follow-up now that he's in Congress. I mean, the time we did that interview, not many people knew the name Dan Crenshaw. Now everyone does.
I would love to get Dan Crenshaw and Ocasio-Cortez in the same room just for like 5 minutes just to see what... I'm sure
they're going to be in the same room.
I'm sure they're both very nice people and they would be nice to each other, but that would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, at some point they probably will. I mean,
yeah,
they're
freshman
congressmen.
Yeah.
They're going to end up talking at some point. But it was actually interesting listening back to the interview, which I haven't done because it was a year ago. And you and him especially had a very frank discussion on foreign policy, and he didn't give a political answer. Like, he did take a stand. You know, during the clip, you asked him about, you know, are we just going to stay occupied in Iraq or Afghanistan just for the end of time? And he was pretty blunt about it. He was like, yeah, we've been in South Korea. We've been in Japan. I don't see a problem with that. A lot of politicians wouldn't give you a straightforward answer like that. And you guys weren't completely in a line on it, but at least he gave an actual answer.
No, well, I disagreed with him on quite a few things, as I recall. I'd have to go back and listen to that interview again. But no, it was still a good interview. You know, I appreciated him being, you know, candid and forthright. Wished him luck in the election. I mean, I thought it was really cool that he was like, you know, I want to find some other way to continue to like serve my country and maybe this is it. And so you never know how that's going to go. A lot of veterans, you know, run for office and don't make it in, for all kinds of different reasons. And, Dan was successful and not only was he successful, but he also became something of a, media sensation.
Yeah.
Because of Saturday Night Live and everything else, but.
And I even saw that Candace Owens tweeted out, she's like, whether you like Candace Owens or not, I mean, she's just a prominent voice out there and said, you know, I saw him speak and I believe this is the future of the Republican Party. So, like, that's pretty high praise.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dan Crenshaw getting sworn in, Ocasio-Cortez, and what's the other one that you like so much?
I just know it's the Muslim woman with the hijab, but I actually saw this today. It's kind of making the rounds today, her tweet. I'll find that. I remember her actual name. I know she's in Minneapolis. It is Ilhan Omar.
So Omar and Ocasio-Cortez are trying to stop Nancy Pelosi from the pay-as-you-go scheme. Of funding the government, because they're like, well, if we do that, then we won't have any money to fund our, you know, extensive, massive, labyrinthine sort of social programs, you know, that they want like some kind of soft communism. So we can't do pay as our goal. So they're trying to like stymie Nancy Pelosi on that. And I think the two of them are going to give Pelosi a freaking heart attack the way things are going.
So the tweet that's making the rounds today is actually from November of 2012. But she wrote, Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel and hashtag Gaza, hashtag Palestine, hashtag Israel. I mean, to be honest, like, there's probably plenty of people in Congress who are critical of Israel, but like that tweet from someone who's now a congresswoman, I do find problematic. You know, in all honesty, like I look at that tweet and it's like, is this Osama bin Laden tweeting or is this a future U.S. congresswoman?
I mean, Israel has an extensive propaganda system.
Oh, for sure.
You know, I think I understand, like if I was to interpret a little bit, I think I understand what she's probably trying to say there. But then on the other hand, you look at that and it's like, well, what's the difference between this and, you know, like George Soros conspiracies?
But also, you know, I know that they're talking or she's referring to specific things.
I think she is, too.
But this is like making the jump between, all right, America has killed Anwar al-Awlaki, U.S. citizen, along with his teenage son. You could be critical of that, but that's different than tweeting out something like the U.S. is the great Satan because of it. And to me, this is closer to that second tweet.
It kind of like evoking God.
Yeah.
May Allah awaken the people. Like, what the fuck? Like, you're calling on the man upstairs to awaken the... Like, yeah. It's very messianic. And if a Christian evangelical... was to send start tweeting things like this or saying things like this, who is a public official, we'd all kind of be like, what the fuck are you doing, man? Like,
yeah.
Where are you going with this?
I could go on about this, but before we get to our guest, Paul DeGelder, I know you had something really critical to talk about that's really within our wheelhouse.
Well, I would bring up real quick, fast, that to my surprise, I found myself writing actually two fairly complimentary articles towards President Trump.
Oh, yeah.
Which
that's right.
I don't do very often.
But about Syria, right?
About Syria and about his visit to Iraq. And I don't want to, maybe not complimenting him, but pumping the brakes on the criticism a little bit. The way he was being criticized for going to Iraq and having a stupid, silly photo op. As all of our presidents and many of our politicians do, I just thought the kind of like manufactured outrage around it was just completely asinine and silly. And then the other article I wrote was about Trump's decision to withdraw from Syria and how I think I expressed concerns at the time that, you know, we could leave a power vacuum, we could plunge this area back into chaos. It's kind of flushing a lot of our hard work down the toilet. What seems to have happened with him making that announcement was it really put a boot in the ass of some of the players on the ground to start hashing things out and negotiating some of their differences. And what I'm talking about specifically is to get the Assad regime and the Syrian Democratic Forces in North Syria to start talking to one another and negotiate that northeastern area, or I'm sorry, northwestern part of Syria, to negotiate their re-entry into the Syrian state. Because otherwise, with America no longer there, you know, the Turks are going to invade the place. I mean, that's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. So I think Trump did the right thing in calling bullshit on his security advisors and the generals and the Pentagon and everyone else and making this decision. You know, these wars can't go on forever. They can't be indefinite. And the manufactured outrage around that was incredible. Just to see, you know, Rachel Maddow wrote an entire book about, you know, the forever war and American military expansion, you know, how powerful presidents have become in deploying military forces.
Yeah.
But then when Trump decides to withdraw the troops, she's like, he's trying to wag the dog and manipulate the media cycle, and this is an irresponsible decision. It's incredible because there is no anti-war movement in America at all anymore. And these people who would describe themselves as anti-war progressive liberals have been pushed so far past their own principles and their own values by President Trump. They can't even remember what it was they used to believe. They're simply opposed to anything this guy tries to do, even if it happens to align with their values.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, I'll take a win where I can get a win.
Yeah.
Right. I'm pragmatic about it. And I think no matter who you are, whatever your political beliefs are, you have to be pragmatic. We can't have our heads in the clouds and just hope for utopia to happen. Sure. You know,
isn't it still extremely early on, though, to say that there won't be a power vacuum and a similar situation?
It is. And Trump has also reversed course a bit and said, well, okay, we'll leave troops there another, you know, 2 or 3 months to hash things out and make sure everything's stable. Will he end up? I mean, this is Donald Trump. He may change his mind again and say, "Now we're just going to stay there."
Yeah.
I mean, you just don't know.
Did you see the clip of him saying, "I think I would make a great general. Who knows?"
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was one of those typical like Donald Trump, you know, drunken rambling. You know, your drunk uncle at Thanksgiving.
Even though he's never touched alcohol, so.
I think he has touched alcohol. He just stopped drinking after his brother died.
Okay.
But good for
which is a long but
good,
time
good for
ago,
good so. For him. I'm not trying to make fun of him for not drinking or anything like that.
But I mean, at least in his adult life, the guy's never drank.
Yeah, yeah. He just these like rambling comments. I mean, if it sounds like somebody who's drunk, or if they're not drunk, has like the you know dementia or something. Yeah. Like what are you talking about, man? But anyway, I was surprised to find myself writing a couple articles in defense of Donald Trump. I mean, but hey, like I said, I'll take a win where I can take it. You know, Republicans are going to, if they manage a couple of good things during this administration, I'll give them a pat on the back for that. That's
no,
fine.
I believe you're truly objective in that. You've even tweeted out things for Ortiz, as you said, that you'll agree with. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's
or is it Cortez? I'm forgetting Alexandria
Ocasio-Cortez.
Cortez,
right? Yeah. And I apologize if I said her name wrong. But some of her tweets I get a kick out of because she's kind of like I think we talked about it on the last podcast where she sees some like corruption,
yeah,
you know, going on in government in D.C. And she's a young woman. I think she's like 27, and this is probably her first real exposure to politics. And she's probably seeing all this stuff like, oh, my God, like, yeah, what the fuck is going on here? So she sends out, I think, some of these like very candid tweets sometimes about like I picture her just being in kind of shock about it. And I'm just like, damn. And I think, you know, Nancy Pelosi must be like about to have a stroke sometimes, like seeing some of this stuff. But hey, you know, I think it's great whenever the stupidity gets exposed. I'm happy to see that. And yeah, we'll see what the future holds.
So we got to get to Paul Gelder, actually, in about 5 minutes. So I don't know if real quickly we want to cover Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher being court-martialed.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring this up again because the news is coming out that it is going to court-martial now. You know, Chief Gallagher is going to stand trial for murder. Other war crimes he may have committed. I mean, there have been a lot of allegations coming from the SEALs he served with. It's not just that. I mean, yeah, it's the murder of this kid, the alleged murder of this kid who he supposedly stabbed to death. That was the kid was a detainee, and then filmed it, et cetera, et cetera. Also allegations that other SEALs helped cover it up. Allegations that he tried to bribe. I saw one article. They said he tried to bribe other SEALs to get them to be quiet. I mean, the story just kind of gets worse and worse. And then I've seen the narrative being put forward by his family members, actually, that, you know, the other SEALs that he served with were, I mean, I think some of these words may have even been used specifically that, you know, they were just a bunch of pussies, that, you know, his teammates were weak. They didn't like him being a strong leader and, you know, pushing them in combat, things like this. And so they retaliated against him and they went to NCIS and like, and I guess to this day, this narrative is that they're still lying to NCIS and they're lying under oath, you know, to the courts,
which would do nothing for them. So,
well, it'll actually put you in fucking jail. I mean, that's perjury.
No, but I mean, it would do nothing for them to, you know, if they are making testimony against this guy, like they're not getting anything out.
Right,
of it,
so. Right. And I mean,
I know what you're saying, if they're lying, yeah.
The Navy has systematically covered up war crimes, quite frankly. The SEAL teams, specifically in SEAL Team 6. So, I mean, this isn't like where you have a bunch of teammates coming forward and saying, I mean, it tells to me, my impression is things must have been really, really bad. Like, so beyond the pale that these guys came forward. Because this isn't something that happens every day, mm-hmm. where they start diming out their own, their own NCO. So we'll see how this case pans out. I feel like his defense, his attorneys are trying to try this in the court of public opinion by saying, like, yeah, they have not said these words specifically, but I get the feeling they want to make it like a Fox News court martial and say, you know, it's the libs and they're persecuting this heroic Navy SEAL. I feel
I saw from the article, there's apparently, I don't know if it was that article or the older one, there were two veteran charities donating to his legal defense.
Yeah, there are. So I feel like that's the narrative that is being advanced. And I don't know, maybe they're trying to angle for a presidential pardon, because that's the world we live in right now. You know, you get enough traction on Twitter. I mean, it could influence presidential pardons. But anyway, we'll keep an eye on it and see how the court martial pans out.
Yeah. And by the way, for the listeners, Jack will cover that in his, I was going to say news roundup, but that was BK's thing. What do we call what you do?
I don't know. I'm just doing like a weekly news segment and talking, you know, it's a video segment, talking for a couple minutes about, you know, news of the day. And we'll probably talk a little bit about this today.
Yeah. So if you go on the newsrep.com, you should see that up around the time that this goes up, and check out that segment. We've been posting it as well on NewsRep's Instagram. With that, joining us for the first time on the podcast, Paul DeGelder, former Australian Army paratrooper, as well as Navy clearance diver, the author of No Time for Fear, How a Shark Attack Survivor Beat the Odds, also host on Shark Week, one of the stars of the Australian drama series Fighting Season. And I mean, the big thing that's a part of your story and that you document in your book is losing your right hand, part of your right arm as well, and right leg in a shark attack. And I mean, the story behind this is pretty insane. It's not something people think is going to happen when they join the military. I mean, you have to be in fear of your life for combat situations, but a shark attack, I've heard you describe it as well, like you'd be more likely to win the lottery.
Yeah. It definitely wasn't something that I was expecting going into just a normal day at work. Diving and swimming in Sydney Harbour, where we work all of the time. But in saying that, my greatest fear was sharks. And so it's almost like I created my worst nightmare by visualizing it so much. But, you know, in the job that we have, you know, whether it's combat or whether it's dealing with explosives or whatever, you know, it is a dangerous realm, and you know, you can't get pissed off and upset when you choose a dangerous path and then something goes wrong. That's down to the universe and destiny or whatever you want to call it. But what happens next is what really matters.
Well, could you start just backtrack a little bit and tell us, since you know we cover the military quite a bit, and we've had a couple of Australians, but not too many. Probably not enough on the podcast. I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your path into joining the Australian military in your military career.
Yeah. Who else have you had?
We had a long time ago, we had a guy from Sasser on, Malar, Rob Malar.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like I've met Rob, but I can't remember that. I know the name very well. We have some mutual friends. He was a sniper or something.
Yeah.
So I think like a lot of people, I joined out of desperation just because I had this overwhelming sense of adventure, but it was misdirected into other areas. You know, my dad was a cop, and, we grew up, you know, six people in the family on a policeman's wage in the 80s. So not a lot of money. I struggled with, my dog's getting in the way. I struggled with, getting bullied at school because I was short and skinny and had big ears and face full of freckles, and then struggling with the whole not being able to keep up with the Joneses type scenario. You know, you don't get the cooler sneakers, you got secondhand bikes, your mum makes your clothes, hungry all the time. And so when I had hit a growth spurt around 15, I started doing Muay Thai and I started fighting back. And that gave me some great confidence, but that was also misdirected. And then I had the confidence to, you know, go and start stealing things to get the things that I wanted to keep up with my buddies and get the nice sneakers and the clothes. You know, we'd go out and shoplift, or we'd break into cars, or we'd steal cars, or, you know, and, I wanted money, but for some reason I didn't feel like I wanted to work. You know, I don't understand what goes through your head when you're a teenager. So I started selling weed, and it wasn't the path that I dreamed of. I grew up in a small city in Australia called Canberra, which is the capital, and just a really boring place back then. But I did grow up watching people like Steve Irwin and David Attenborough, and I read constantly. I didn't do well in school, but I did read a lot. And so I knew that there was this incredible world out there, and I had no idea how to be a part of it. How was I going to get out and see it all? And so one night I got jumped by 20 guys just before my 21st birthday. And at the point I was working behind bars in nightclubs and working as a kitchen hand, and I was selling weed on the side. And I got jumped and just really had my ass kicked and decided that I couldn't be there anymore. I had to somehow remove myself from this environment. And so I moved away. I drove 12 hours north to a place called Brisbane, and I tried to start again. I was working behind a bar in a strip club, and I was making rap music. You know, it's a whole different change of career. And it was cool fun, you know. It was something different. It was new friends. It was a new city. But at the end of the day, I took the problem with me because I was the problem. And so it all fell apart. And just out of sheer desperation, I decided to join the army. And my two younger brothers had already joined, and they were in artillery, and they laughed at me when I said I was going to join. But they did say, you know, if you're going to join, just don't join infantry. Whatever you do, you won't make it. It's too hard. So I joined infantry and showed them.
Dude, the infantry is the army. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's how I saw it. I never really know about any other jobs in the army. I looked at the list of jobs when I was in at the enlistment, enlistment office. Mm-hmm. And they had this thing called an assault pioneer. And I was like, oh my God, it sounds like a fucking stormtrooper. That's what I want to do. ended up in the infantry. And that gave me a whole new lease on life. It gave me a whole new set of values and really a sense of pride. And I think that's what helps me the most, you know, wearing that uniform, representing my country, feeling like I was training for and doing something special. It taught me how to push past my boundaries, and it gave me the foundation to build a great life on.
The military can be sometimes we hear about the negative influence of the military. I'm reading this book right now about a ranger who ended up committing a bank robbery in Tacoma. And the book is a lot about from the author's perspective, the negative influence about the military. But I mean, the military is also a vehicle for a lot of people to uplift themselves, pull themselves out of poverty. As you say, learn some positive values and some self-confidence.
Yeah, it really is what you make of it. You
know,
out of my whole intake, you know, there was, I think there was eight of us from my infantry training school intake that went to airborne. And of those eight, after 2 years, I was the only one still there. All the rest of them had mostly gone AWOL. And I couldn't perceive how you would go through, you know, boot camp and then infantry training school, and then you get to the easy part and then you bail out. Like, at the battalion, you've got your weekends off a lot of the time. You're making more money. You don't get treated like a bag of dicks like you do in fucking training. And I couldn't wrap my head around why they would leave now. And like you said, I've had buddies end up in jail, people that have done robberies and started dealing drugs, and you know, they chose the wrong path. They didn't see the benefit in what they were doing. They didn't see, I guess, the pride and the sense of achievement in being a representative of the armed forces for your country.
Yeah, some of the best advice I ever got before joining the military, or probably was the best advice, was that you get out of it what you put into it. And that's absolutely true.
Yeah, and it's not to say I was a perfect soldier by
any means. Yeah, but you try. Every day you wake up, you try.
I have a very poor retention of knowledge, but I know that. And so I know how to combat that. So I just old school parrot fashion, you know, do it over and over and over and over and over again. And so I would work at that, whereas other people just wouldn't. You know, they just, you know, I would go out and get on the piss with them every weekend, and we'd drink ourselves silly and we'd do stupid things. But at the end of the day, I knew that I had this very important job, and I would go back to it with my mind in the game and try really hard. And have heroes, you know, just like before I joined, and I had heroes like Steve Irwin and David Attenborough and all those guys. Inside the army, I was looking for someone else to look up to, someone to follow and emulate. And you start with your section commanders, and then when you start to meet more people in the battalion, you learn about the recon guys and the sniper guys and the heavy weapons and the guys that transfer out and go to special operations. And, you know, those were the people that I was trying to look up to and emulate so that I would be maybe one day in their situation where someone would be looking up to me and I could set the good example and feel good about myself, because I think that was a really detracting factor of who I was before the military. I didn't feel good about myself.
Is that how you ended up becoming a diver, that you saw that as the next kind of career progression, the next special skill to learn?
I kind of was looking for something. I'd just come back about 6 months previous to that from operations with the UN in East Timor as a peacekeeper. And and then I got, I was away on exercise, and the company commander called my CSM, my company sergeant major, to talk to me. And I was like, I'm just a private soldier away on exercise. And my CSM comes up to me with the phone and says, Here you go, Dutchie. It's the boss. He wants to talk to you. And I'm just thinking, what the fuck does the boss want to talk to me about? And he's like, he simply said, hey, Dutchie, do you want to go to the sandpit? And I said, fucking A, boss. And so I packed up all my kit, and me and a few other guys have been selected to go over to Iraq to bolster a security detachment. And I was all in, man. I was like, fuck yeah, this is the next step. And we went and got all our desert cams and our language CD-ROMs and all that crazy stuff to get ready, and started doing briefings. And then 4 days before we left, they canceled the trip on us. The chief of the army decided he didn't want to send anyone for less than 3 months, and we were going over to help for 2.5. And so they canned it on us, and my motivation just went down the drain. And my work ethic started to slip, and I started seeing the flaws and not the benefits in what I was doing. I was looking down the barrel of just going back to doing the same old exercises every year. You know, I know how to do this fucking job inside out. And I just didn't want to be one of those dissatisfied, crusty old sergeants.
That
hates life and is just angry all the time. No, I came into this job loving it and enjoying it. I wanted to continue down that path. And then we were doing Hewitt training, so helicopter underwater escape training, because we were about to go on exercise to New Caledonia and do a mock evacuation of foreign nationals. And so we're going to be flying over the ocean. And so to get qualified to do that, you have to do that Hewitt course. And one of the guys that was a safety diver to make sure the army guys didn't drown was this thing called a clearance diver. And I'd heard about these guys. They were up on the echelons of the SAS and the commandos, and they were special, you know. And I started learning about it from talking to this safety diver, and it just sounded amazing. And so that was when I decided. Now, I talked to a buddy of mine, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to go be a clearance diver. I'm like, oh, I just found out about this shit. I'm going to come do it with you. And then he pulled out, and I was like, fuck it, I'm too deep. I'm gone. But I kept getting sent away on exercises over, and I just I'm an endurance athlete. Like, I could run forever. I could pack march forever. I could swim forever. So I couldn't put on any weight. And I knew that I needed to get strong to be able to get past this course. You know, it's not just solely about endurance. And so I couldn't maintain any weight because I couldn't get into the gym. I had no time. And so I went to my boss and I asked him if I could go down to the regimental store, which is where, you know, we have people that are maybe injured or something. They go down there and they sell the guys from the battalion their packs and their webbing and gloves and all that sort of extra stuff. And he wouldn't let me go. And I couldn't work out why, because we really weren't doing anything that important. And he knew that I really, really wanted this. I had 6 months to train, no, 3 months to train. And he said, look, I'll let you go on one condition. If you stay in the company and you help us win the athletics carnival, the cross-country carnival, and the swimming carnival, I'll let you go to the RI store. And so I did. I agreed to it, and we won all three trophies. Not saying that I was the defining factor by any means, but I did play a part. And so he let me go down there, and that's when I started training my ass off. And it was lucky I did, because I didn't really know what I was headed for, but I'd heard rumors, and it was pretty terrifying. But I hadn't, you know, it was way beyond what I thought it was. It was way harder.
Well, what was dive school like? What did they do to you guys? I mean, ours is known. We have a couple different dive schools. The Special Forces has one, the SEALs have one, and then there's more like conventional Navy divers. But I mean, they're all kind of regarded as a big kick in the balls.
Ours is a little different to everything that you have in the US, because we just don't have the personnel to specialize.
Right.
And so we have to do everything. Mm-hmm. But the first course is ship's divers, where you learn to scuba dive and, you know, do hull searches for limpet mines and do seabed searches. And that was pretty tough, because I was learning to be in the Navy and also to dive, which I'd never done before in my life. And then the sciences behind diving as well. And that, I think that was probably the hardest bit of that section, retaining the knowledge of all the diving sciences. There's a lot like out of Men of Honor, where Cuba Gooding Jr. is just like flunking and flunking and flunking. And so I struggled with that, but I passed. I got through it by the skin of my dick. And that was when you go on to what was called CDAT at the time, clearance diver acceptance testing. And that was 10 days of just emotional, mental, and physical anguish. You know, your day starts at 2 a.m. And the you get in there the very first day and you do this four-hour run. And it's Indian file and hill sprints and stair sprints and fireman carries and all that good stuff for 4 hours. And you get back to the dive school at about 7:30, and everyone is trash. We had about 36 people on selection at that first day. And they said, all right, you got 5 minutes to stretch, and then we're doing it again. And instantly five people just handed in you wear these fluoro vests, neon vests, and instantly four people just handed them in. You know, that was day one. And then you literally go and do it again for another 4 hours of running. And then, you know, you get a couple of hours sleep and you're swimming across Sydney Harbour for 6 hours in the middle of the night. And then you get another couple of hours sleep and it's a half marathon. Then it's 5 hours of PT on the soft sand at the beach. And it's just on and on and on and on and on nonstop. So the mind games and breath hold and pulling boats through the harbour and canoeing and carrying canoes up mountains with, you know, three or four 40 gallon water containers in it. It just pushed me beyond anything I thought was achievable from my own body. And we ended up with seven guys.
Wow. And then once you get into the training aspects, because you're saying you don't have the opportunities to, you know, just specialize in one thing. So, I mean, do you do the underwater demolition piece? You do the saturation diving? I mean, you get a little bit of all of it?
Yeah, we get a bit of everything. We don't do the saturation diving. I think the Australian Navy is a little bit scared of that. They don't even like us running into real-time deco, to be honest, if they don't have to. So what we do is we do MTO, so Maritime Tactical Operations. And this has changed now. They've gone into expeditionary forces, and the format has changed, but it's fundamentally the same job. So it's long-range reconnaissance swimming on O2, clearing beaches and beachheads, and clearing, you know, up to 2 kilometers inland for the ships to come in and not hit mines or obstructions and, you know, all that sort of good stuff. And then it's shallow water mine disposal as well on the O2. Then we do underwater battle damage repair under UBDR, and that's diving on the helmets and the bandmasks, using the drills and the chainsaws, all that underwater, the welding, the ultrathermic broco cutting guns, all that good stuff. Then there's MCM, mine countermeasures. So we'll be diving on what you guys call the Mark 16s. Yeah. We call it the A5800, and we'll be doing mixed gas, deep diving, min magnetic to get rid of all the mines, blow in place and render safe, or, you know, retrieve and take back to shore and take it apart so we can study it. Then there's also EOD, land-based EOD. We do that too. And then you can also go over to the CT squads and do counterterrorism with the commandos. So it's a really multifaceted role, and you have to know how to be able to do all of it so that, you know, maybe there's a guy missing from a tactical operations team. You have to be able to come out of your job doing battle damage repair and fit straight into that role, knowing exactly what you're doing in that day. And so it's pretty full on. The learning curve is insane. It goes for 38 weeks nonstop. So, but at the same time, it's so fulfilling and it's so interesting because you never know what you're going to be doing day to day. One day you're jumping out of a helicopter doing an aerial mine disposal. The next day you might be, I don't know, going to Malaysia to do a multinational mine clearance of a bay in a volcanic area. It's just the job is really great, really good.
So you got your
best job in the Navy. I met a guy yesterday. He was like, "Oh, I'm thinking of joining the Navy. What did you do?" I said, "I did this job," and he's like, "Oh, what do you reckon about the rest of the Navy?" I reckon, shit. I would not want to be anything in the Navy except a diver.
It sounds like you got your wish, when you left the infantry, of not doing the same training exercises over and over and over again.
And it was really good training being in the Army and doing all that pack marching as well, because when I went on selection course, I didn't get a single blister. Not one. I turned up to PT in an old beat up pair of basketball shoes. I packed march forever with everyone. And at the end of the day, that, you know, one guy was taping up his whole ball bag with strapping tape, individual toes. I get in their room. They hated me. I get in the room, take my boots off and go to sleep.
So then what was it like when you got to your unit? And did you get deployed overseas again?
Yeah, that was the thing. You remember how I said, I got a little pissed off that I didn't get deployed?
Yeah.
I thought I was going to the clearance divers where I get deployed operationally all around the world, diving and doing whatever. Didn't go anywhere. My buddies from the Army went to Iraq and Afghanistan like 3 or 4 times. So it was a bit of a kick in the balls, but at the same time, I loved my job. I loved what we did. We did exercises all over the place. We did RIMPAC and we did Bersama Lima, and we go to Malaysia and Singapore and Hawaii and, really cool places, work with really amazing guys. But I think it was more along the lines of the Navy just didn't really know how to deploy us that well. They didn't fully – the big brass up the top just didn't fully comprehend the capabilities of the clearance divers. And so – You'd have guys getting sent to Iraq and Afghanistan, but it'd be one officer, one chief or PO, and one leading seaman. And that'd be the EOD detachment. And that's all they'd send. And then once they came home from 6 or 8 months, then another 3 would go over. And it was so – the rotation was so slow, you just couldn't get over there. And everyone wanted to go. You couldn't get a trip. Whereas the SAS and the commandos are going back to back to back.
When the clearance divers go and they fill that CT role you're talking about with the commandos, are they kind of filling that capability that we typically associate with Navy SEALs?
No, it's domestic. It's domestic counterterrorism.
The tactical assault group? Is that what it's called?
Exactly. Yeah, TAG. TAG on the East Coast. So generally speaking, before they were created, the SAS used to do that role. Mm-hmm. They were the long-range reconnaissance guys and also the counterterrorism guys as well. Then the commandos really started coming into play around, I think it was because two commandos were 4RAR, 4th Battalion Royal Australian Regiment. And that was where we used to send our rejects when I first got to the Airborne Battalion. And then a lot of money started getting pumped into them and pumped into their training, and they just became this whole other beast. And they're like they're more like the SEALs. You know, they go in and
pretty
they
serious
just
force
kill
now.
Everyone and blow everything up and then fly out again.
And so your guys would augment them and do the underwater aspect.
Yeah, exactly. Because the army people don't like to swim, so they'd have the water platoon where the clearance divers would go in and swim in so the army guys could helicopter in.
So then we got to get into, what did you know about sharks at this point in time in your training? I mean, was this something sharks, that you said you had a big fear of sharks?
Yeah, man, I thought... I had no knowledge. I was just like everyone else. I didn't really have a knowledge of the role they played in the ocean. I just thought if we kill them all, then we don't have to worry about them. Then I can go surfing and diving. You know, we're diving in water where you can't even see your hand in front of your face, trying to put together, you know, 500-pound bombs. And you just get bumped by these things, and you just hope and pray it's not going to bite you. So I just thought, wipe them out. Fuck them. It wasn't until later... after the shark attack, when I had to really learn about them, because the shark attack was such a huge event in Australia. Everyone knew about it, that every time there was another shark interaction in Australia, the media would come to me for a comment.
Oh my God.
So just out of the sheer desire to not look like a dumbass on television, I needed to learn about sharks. And so that's how my knowledge started to grow.
So what happened the day of the attack?
We were doing a counterterrorism trial of some new equipment. The R&D department of the military wanted to test this unmanned video and sonar. So they could put this equipment on the wharf anywhere, they could turn it on and walk away, and the video would automatically track movement in the water, and then they'd have sonar as well underneath, and that would automatically track a subsurface attack swimmer. So it was going to be three phases. We were going to be doing surface swimming, scuba, and then O2 to see if this equipment could get us. We didn't get to phase two or three. We started phase one. We had one of the new guys in the water, and then after about 30 minutes, I pulled him out and I took over to just give him a break. And I was swimming on the surface in a wetsuit, a pair of fins, right alongside the Navy base in Sydney Harbour. It's called Garden Island. So obviously a place where we've worked thousands of times over decades. And I'm in the water for about 4 or 5 minutes on the surface, kicking my legs. And I look over my shoulder to make sure that I'm still headed towards the bow of the warship. And I just get a massive whack in my leg. Didn't really hurt, just... you know, it felt like someone hit me, and maybe like the boat ran into me or something. And so I turn around expecting to see a bit of driftwood or a boat or some shit, and there's this just massive shark head staring at me.
Oh, man.
You know, your worst nightmare. And so I didn't know what to do. It was just like my mind couldn't perceive what I was seeing because I'd never seen it before. And so it took a second or two, and then I thought, I've got to get this thing off me. My survival instincts kicked in. I thought, I've got to jab it in the eyeball. You know, that's what you hear on Shark Week, jab it in the eyeball. But it had my hand in its mouth. And I pulled it, and I felt a bit of pain and a bit of tearing. And I looked down, and I could see the teeth pulling the flesh away from my arm. And so I thought, okay, left hand. And I reached over, but I couldn't reach the eyeball because it had me by the back of the leg and the hand in the same bite. So I put my hand on its nose, and I tried to push it off that way. But all that did was push the teeth of the lower jaw deeper into my leg, and a little bit of pain off that too. But I think at that point, my adrenaline had kicked in so much that the pain was a little numb. And so I tried to punch it in the nose, last ditch effort to get it off me, punch it in the nose. But as soon as my punch was coming in, it started to shake me. And the pain was just so immense that all the strength went out of me. And there was just nothing I could do. Like, the bull shark's jaws work in unison when they shake their head to saw through flesh. And so it was sawing through my, imagine like a bear trap with 36 razor blades either side. Instead of clamping down, it clamps down, and then it just starts sawing through your flesh. And it's the only way I can describe it. It was like out of one of those Saw movies. It was so unbelievably painful. There was nothing I could do. The fight went out of me, and I just, you know, it lasted about 8 to 10 seconds, and towards the end there, I just thought, I'm dead. There's nothing I can do. This thing is so strong. I've got nothing to grab onto. I can't fight back. I'm drowning. I'm going to die. And so I just kind of let myself go. And a calm washed over me. And I realized that I was ready. You know, I'd done some amazing things in my life. I'd done things that I never thought that I personally could achieve. And I'd done it. And so I thought, you know what, if I'm going to go, I'm ready to go. And the shark eventually sawed through my whole leg and my hand and removed it. And because I wasn't attached to it anymore, my wetsuit made me buoyant and I popped to the surface. And its tail thrashed in the water right in front of my face. And that kind of brought me back to reality and realized I wasn't dead. And I thought, my safety boat's there. I can see it there. So I've got to get out of here before it comes back and it takes another shot at me. And so I start to swim. But when I take my arm out of the water to take a stroke, my hand's totally gone. You know, my arm ends at the end of my wetsuit. And so my medical training kicks in and I think I've got to keep that wound above my heart to slow the bleeding. So I've got my arm out of the water. I'm swimming back to the safety boat. And for some reason, I can't feel my leg. You know, I'm kicking with my left leg, but I can't feel my right leg at all. I don't know what's going on. The guys in the safety boat had obviously seen the ruckus and they saw the shark's fin and they knew what was going on. So they were coming in to try and rescue me. They said that when they got in close, I was actually swimming through a pool of my own blood that was so thick they could taste it when they got in closer. You know, it was just pouring out of my leg. I didn't even realize. I had no idea. I'm just focused on that boat, you know, the longest swim of my life, thinking there's no way I'm going to get to that boat. It's too far away. This shark's going to come back and get me. Or we know there's bull sharks in the harbor. I figure another shark's going to come and grab me because of all the blood and I'm going to die. But I just, my wetsuit's made me buoyant. I'm not sinking. So I just keep swimming with one leg and one hand. And eventually the boys get to me first. They pull me out of the water, lay me flat in the boat, and I just pass out. I'm so relieved that I'm not going to get bitten again. I just relax and pass out. And that's when they all, you know, spring into action. All that training kicks in. One guy's pounding me in the chest to bring me back to consciousness because he thinks I'm going into cardiac arrest. Another guy's putting a tourniquet, like a strap from a life jacket around the top of my wound. The other guy's driving the boat back to the pier. And it's only, we were right alongside it, so it wasn't far. But the wharf was about 10 foot above the water. So they couldn't get me up onto it. They got me onto a pontoon that was, you know, a foot above the water. And then all the staff ashore had to go and assemble a whole bunch of workers that were there building something on the Navy base, and they had to go and get all these bits of wood and build a ramp, 9 foot up to the wharf to manhandle me up there to get to the paramedics once they arrive. And so I'm like, and I'm conscious through all of this. You know, I've got my priorities in order. I've asked my buddy Tomo to look after my motorbike. I'm just like, they look all so stressed out. I'm trying to crack jokes. I'm tourniqueting my own arm by holding it with my left hand as tight as I can and just focusing on watching my buddy Tomo's face, listening to his voice, because I know if I can see him, then I'm still alive.
So did you actually lose your arm and your leg, or were they later amputated?
The hand was gone.
Yeah, the shark leg. Amputated for him.
No, but I just mean, when you say that your leg, that you were unaware of what had happened, did it later need to be amputated?
Yeah, the leg needed to be amputated later. So what the shark did was it removed all of my hamstring, almost surgically. Fortunately, you know, we've got the femoral artery that runs up inside our leg, and it missed that by maybe a quarter of an inch. So if it had nicked that, I would have been dead before I was even out of the water. So I got super lucky. One of my mates, Lockie, the new guy that was in the water first, he actually had to stick his hand inside my leg and grab one of the arteries and pinch it closed until the paramedics got there. So he said that's something he never wants to do again.
I bet.
But they kept me alive. They kept the blood flow down. Just out of sheer determination, I stayed awake. And then the paramedics got there, and that was kind of when the pain kicked in. And I was screaming at them for drugs, and they dosed me up, and that just it was the pain was so incredible, the drugs just didn't do anything for ages. And so I'm begging them for more drugs. We're in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, and because they said they couldn't give me any more because of the lack of blood, because of my lowered blood pressure. I started having respiratory issues and I couldn't breathe. I physically didn't have the strength to suck air into my lungs. And so the paramedics had to coach me through that. Just, it was almost like a Lamaze class, like short, shallow breathing until I felt like I had enough strength to take one big gasp and flood my body with oxygen. And, going through that got me to the hospital, and I just went straight into emergency surgery. Thankfully, the surgeons there were incredible, the trauma surgeon, the plastic surgeon. I went through 300 liters of blood. No, 150 liters of blood, which is 300 donations.
That's wild.
And you can have the best paramedics. You can have the best combat-trained medics. You can have the best doctors. But without that blood, without the blood donations from the Red Cross, I'd be dead.
Well, neither of us have gotten a chance yet to read your book, which is No Time for Fear. But I'm sure you describe it in there. But I'm just wondering what the recovery process was like mentally, physically, emotionally, all of that.
Yeah. Understandably, it wasn't the easiest time of my life. But the one thing that kind of helped was I had goals. I had this really crazy goal of trying to get back to work as a clearance diver. And that was fundamentally because I didn't have anything else. I'd flunked high school. I didn't have any real world training. There was nothing else really that I liked doing. And so if I lost my career, then I would have nothing. And I was that made me think about the time in my life where when I got kicked out of home at 17, and I was just not working, getting unemployment, smoking weed, living in a fog, achieving nothing. And I'd achieved so much since that time, living a dream life, living at Bondi Beach, riding a big black Italian sports bike, traveling the world with my buddies, jumping out of aircraft, blowing shit up, shooting guns. I was not willing to give that up. And so that was the driving factor for me to just kick into high gear as soon as humanly possible. I had my leg for a week, but because the shark removed my hamstring and 25 centimeters of my sciatic nerve, I couldn't move it and I couldn't feel it, and I never would again. And so we ended up having the leg removed, and what they did was they cut off my foot. And I do a lot of motivational talking. In America now that I'm based in LA, and I show these surgery photos that I have of this, and I've had 56 people pass out.
And you keep count of every one, I note.
54 men. And one of them wasn't even there. I got a message recently from a woman driving around New Zealand in a camper with her husband, and they were listening to a podcast I did with Rich Roll where I was describing the shark attack. And all of a sudden, she said the camper started veering off the road, and he passed out listening to the description. So it's pretty full on, you know. They cut off my foot. They sliced up the back of my calf muscle, peeled all the calf muscle off the bone, removed the lower leg bones, cut the condyles, the balls off the end of my femur, and then folded all of that calf muscle into the hamstring so that it would fill the gap. And so the surgery was really complicated. And I went through some really, really insane pain directly after that surgery, 20 hours where all I wanted to do was die. You know, I begged my mum to find me a gun so I could kill myself because the pain management team couldn't give me any more drugs. I was on ketamine. I was on morphine. They couldn't give me any more. All I could do was laying in my hospital bed, rolling from side to side, bawling my eyes out, begging for death. It was that crazy because I just didn't know when it was going to stop. And that was why. It wasn't so much the amount of pain. It was the fact that, you know, 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, you know, 17 hours in and it hadn't subsided. And I just, it played such a mind fuck game with me. All I wanted to do was die. But unfortunately, after about 20 hours, it subsided. They gave me more drugs. And then 2 days after that, I started training. Wow. You know, there wasn't really anything I could do, but I couldn't lay there. Like the laying there, the solitude when there was no one there, the overthinking of the situation, mm-hmm. I knew was going to do more damage than anything else. Yeah. So I needed to feel like I was achieving something to that goal of getting back to work, even if it was a micro goal, you know. And I looked up and I couldn't go to the toilet by myself. I couldn't even get out of bed. My leg was hugely swollen, but I could hold on to this handle above my bed and I could pull myself up on it. And so 2 days after I had my leg chopped off, the surgeon came in and found me doing these chin-ups on the bar above my bed. And he wasn't impressed at all.
I mean, a one-arm chin-up. Yeah, it's crazy.
With an IV in your arm, I take it?
Sorry?
With an IV still in your arm, I take it?
Oh, I had an IV in my arm. I had a bulb of ketamine stuck into my stomach. And I had two drainage tubes coming out of my leg to a little plastic sack that sort of sucked all the blood and fluid out of my leg. So I was like, I was rigged up. But that was the goal. And my, you know, my friends, my buddies from work, my buddies from growing up were amazing. They brought in TheraBands and we tied TheraBands off to all around the bed so I could work out and feel like I was achieving something before I could even stand up. But tough times, you know, like those drugs,
yeah,
they play havoc with your stomach. And, you know, I literally shit myself in bed one day, and that, you know, it brought everything toppling down again. I was so embarrassed and I was so ashamed coming from this guy that could physically do anything that was asked of me to being in this bed, a crippled double amputee, shitting myself.
It's like one extreme to the other.
It broke me for a whole day, and I was so scared of what life was going to be like. And one of my best friends came and we talked and he said, look, man, you never feel bad about feeling bad. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Feel bad. Everyone feels bad. Just don't let it ruin your whole day, your whole month, or your whole life.
Yeah.
You know, just feel bad. Identify why you're feeling bad and then try and find a way to repair that or fix it or do something to make yourself feel better. And so those simple words, man, you can never undervalue just a bit of support, just a few guiding words, because he said that to me, you know, a week after I got attacked. And to this day, 10 years later, I still remember it and it still plays a role in my life today. And I pass that message on to people all the time. But 9 weeks in hospital kind of messed with me. I'd lost a shitload of weight. I was super pale because I was under the fluoro lights the whole time. But I really tried to focus on training, my diet and nutrition, drinking lots of water and researching. You know, the Navy wanted me to talk to a counselor, but I didn't really feel like talking to someone I didn't know about how I was feeling. You know, I'd just been doing that with my buddies. I don't need this stranger that I don't know. And she came in anyway. I agreed to it. And she asked me a couple of questions that absolutely did not pertain to anything in my situation. And I realized that she just didn't understand how to, it wasn't her fault. She just didn't understand how to communicate with someone at my level in the military.
Right. Someone who has this like peak physical and mental endurance and performance.
Yeah. Yeah. So I realized that I didn't need to talk about it with her. If I needed to talk, I could talk to my buddies, and I would, you know. I'm not the sort of guy that would hold shit in. If I want to complain, I'll fucking complain. Do that a lot. I learned that a lot in the Army.
Was it something that was like psychologically traumatic you had to deal with? Because I just think I have no experience with this, but I remember watching a video the other day, and it was a guy who was diving off the coast of Maine, very like murky green water. And all of a sudden a great white shark came through the haze straight towards him. Passed on his right side, like a foot.
Hit him in the back of the head?
No, I don't think it hit him, but it was like within a foot of him. And this massive shark just went by him and didn't give a shit about him. Didn't care. But if that shark did give a shit, there wasn't a damn thing he could do about it.
Nothing.
And that has got, I have to think, and I mean, I'd like to ask you, like, is that something that kind of fucks with you? That like you're kind of, there's this aspect of powerlessness when you enter the ocean and you're not necessarily at the top of the food chain.
Yeah, but it's not even just that. You know, the ocean is a dangerous beast. Mm-hmm. You're diving on the Mark 16s that are literally trying to kill you while you're diving on mixed gas with a computer keeping you alive. You know, it's close as you get to going into space, and so. What I've learned to do very well is trust in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I rely on my knowledge, my past experiences, the things that I've learned. And so, you know, the shark thing was never really a problem for me. I don't know why. I just didn't hold on to it. You know, I moved on from that, and you know, and that the shark stuff came later anyway, where I had to face that. It was more about trying to maintain the motivation and the self-belief to continue this training and physical progression, believing that I could get back to work. And, you know, the first day I went back to the Navy, 6 months to the day after the shark attack, and I asked them if I go back to the diving teams, and they said no. I was like, what do you mean no? I'm like, they're like, you have to be deployable for war to go to the teams.
Wow.
Like, oh, well, I've just been watching, you know, Men of Honor, bring it up again, but he went to the diving school to become an instructor. And so I'm like, well, how about I go and teach? I'll go to the diving school. And they thought about it for a while, and they had all these meetings, and they said, look, you can go 3 half-days a week. And so I went 5 full-days a week, and I just didn't leave. Like, they couldn't make me leave. I'd turn up. I'd go into the gym. I would train harder than everyone else there, as hard as I possibly could, and then I'd go to work, and I'd try and, you know, inspire the trainees. Or I think half the time I scared the shit out of them. You know, they get on the boat for their first day, like thinking, oh, fuck yeah, I'm going to be a big bad clearance diver, all bright eyed and bushy tailed. And they get on the boat, and there I am, half man, half mountain bike. I feel like they wouldn't look at me a lot of the time. But I used to sneak up behind them underwater and grab them by the leg and shake the shit out of them. So I can't really blame them.
So you were back to diving when you were an instructor.
Eventually, yeah. At that point, they wouldn't let me use the diving gear. That was just strictly – they didn't say – it's all about loopholes, you know. They didn't say I couldn't breath hold. They just said I couldn't scuba. And so eventually, yeah, I got back. I re-qualified on O2 diving and scuba. I even went on a helmet maintenance course and learned how to take the helmets apart and put them back together with one hand. But at the same time, it was killing me. You know, trying to keep up with everyone, trying to run the scuba divers course, the ship's divers course, and trying just to remain positive and motivated and physically fit and go through the training and set the examples and then work from 6 in the morning till sometimes 2 in the morning, you know, continuously. And it just, I did it for 2.5 years, but it was slowly sucking the life out of me. I just couldn't maintain it. They reckon that walking on a prosthetic leg expends 80% more energy than having two legs. And so here I am trying to run on my blade and walk and train in the gym and then maintain, a 16, 18 hour day as well at work. And it was really sucking the life out of me. I just wanted to go back to the diving teams. And around 2012, I went to my boss and I asked him what the chances were. And he said, look, Paul, under the current command and control, you've got zero chance of going to the teams. And so that was basically when I decided to leave.
And
step out into the scary unknown of civilian life.
I mean, it's amazing. I was going to say the irony from there is, and I've seen this from watching your videos, You went from this experience to now advocating for the preservation of sharks. I mean, people would be blown away by that.
Yeah. Well, you know what, man? We partially become divers in the Navy and scuba divers and ocean swimmers and surfers because we love the ocean. We love the diversity of the animals. We love to see the fish and the octopus, and we love the feeling of being in the ocean. You know, it washes away stresses and stuff like that. And you can't have that without life in the ocean. And I never blame the shark because I chose that life. You know, it wasn't the shark's fault. I was flapping around on the surface in murky water in a black wetsuit and a pair of black fins. You know, I look like food.
On that note, since you've become a big conservationist, for sharks, I was wondering if you have learned anything about shark behavior. Like, how come the shark? I mean, did it realize that you're not its normal prey? Is that why it didn't come back and try to take another bite out of you? I mean, what is the current thoughts on that?
That's my assumption. It was early in the morning. It was overcast. The water's murky. So really low light levels. The shark probably couldn't see very well. A black wetsuit, pair of black fins. I looked like an injured seal. Mm-hmm. I wasn't moving too fast. I'm just flopping around on the surface. So it came up for a test bite, what they call an exploratory bite. And what I think happened was it didn't hit any really solid bone. And I think if it had actually hit my femur, one, I probably would have died because it would have gone through my femoral artery, but it would have felt that really hard, thick bone, and it probably would have let go, like a lot of great white sharks do.
Oh, I see.
You know, very few people get eaten by sharks. They get a bite, and just because we're very delicate beings, we have all this cardiovascular system, and we bleed out, we die. But because it didn't hit any of those bones, it just hit this big chunk of flesh. It just kept going and going and going. And then I guess it either didn't like what it tasted, or it was full, or who knows. But or maybe it was coming back. It was coming back. But sharks don't. It didn't just swim in. It was stalking my buddy for a while before it got me. They don't just swim in and bite. You know, they'll stalk, especially bull sharks. They're very inquisitive, but they're very cautious as well. And it would have been swimming around and around for ages. So maybe it was following me back to the boat, but it just didn't get a chance to strike again.
So, I mean, on one hand, I mean, you'd think human beings are like easy prey. Why don't they eat us more often? But you, at least from what I've seen on like television and stuff, the sharks really don't like us.
Yeah. Well, you know, they know what their food is, basically. You know, the juvenile great whites, they generally eat squid and octopus and eels and rays, and then the big sharks, as they mature, they get bigger, they have to move on to bigger fish, and then they move on to mammals like seals and dolphins, and the bull sharks generally eat fish and eels and things like that. So they know what their food is. Mm-hmm. That's why they're not attacking us. If they wanted to attack us, we'd be dying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so it was just bad luck.
And because of this whole experience, you've gotten the chance to do work with Shark Week. And from what I know, that's something you're very passionate about.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. You know, that, and like I was saying earlier about my heroes, Steve Irwin and David Attenborough, Dr. Suzuki, all those amazing naturalists that share the wilds of nature with the world through TV. I literally get to walk in the footsteps of my heroes.
Cool.
And that is an amazing feeling. And not just that, but it's a great transfer from military life. I'm not shooting guns all the time. Occasionally now I'm in America. I'm not blowing stuff up. I'm not, not always jumping out of helicopters. I'm just on parachute course at the moment for my next show.
Where are you, by the way?
I'm in LA.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm just about to. I've got a couple more weeks of parachuting before I go on to another show where I got to parachute into the South Pacific and survive for 2 days and two nights while they chum for sharks.
What?
Yeah, I'm really dumb. I don't learn my lesson.
I'd love to talk to the insurance company that blessed off on that. Like, here's what we're going to do, boys.
Have you ever met our friend Terry Shepard? He's done stuff for Shark Week.
No, I haven't.
Okay, and he's a former Green Beret. Yeah, well, I mean...
Yeah, Terry's a good guy.
I think it's been a few years since he's been on, but I know Terry did some stuff for Shark Week, so...
Okay.
You guys probably get along.
It's a great job, you know, and you don't have the military sucking the fun out of the adventure. Working with a film crew is way more fun, but it's become a passion as well, because as you learn about the plight of the oceans and the sharks, everything from pollution to plastic to commercial fishing to the shark finning trade, you know, you can't help but want to stand up and speak out for it, because we're literally killing our own planet and, you know, along the chain ourselves. So trying to help people understand the role that the sharks play, you know, is just one little piece of the Jenga puzzle that you don't want to be pulled out totally and have the whole ecosystem topple over.
So that's a enduring problem, the overfishing of sharks, or is it more of like environmental pollution? What are kind of the issues facing that part of the ecology right now?
Well, man, this is a long conversation.
I know it is.
It is animal agriculture. So the farming of animals is one of the big things that's a problem, creating dead zones in the ocean, the coastal areas, because of all the runoff of the fungicides and the pesticides and the all that sort of stuff, the methane gas. But also plastic pollution is huge. That is a massive problem. Then there's the commercial fishing, which is wiping out the ocean of fish stocks, and that's through bycatch. It's not even through the fishing of the targeted species. Yeah. It's the catch that they're getting that they don't want, that they're throwing back into the ocean dead, which a lot of that can be sharks, seals, dolphins, rays, it's whales.
Because if you get a can of tuna fish now, don't they still have that little thing on there that says it's dolphin safe nets and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. There's with the current regulations, how they are around the planet, there's no such thing as sustainable fishing. There really isn't, because it's so unregulated in other areas, and there's so much illegal fishing that it's just been wiped out, and the coral reefs are being destroyed by these, you know, massive football field nets that are dragged along the bottom of the ocean, scooping up everything in their path. So you're killing the environment that these animals live in as well, not just the animals. So even if there are some to repopulate, they don't have a home to repopulate in.
Well, I think this transitions kind of nicely into a next topic I wanted to bring up here. You follow a strictly plant-based diet, and I think people would see you, especially with the amputated limbs, and would
being
think,
an athlete.
Yeah, being an athlete, would think that you are someone who needs to ingest animal protein. And, I mean, a strictly plant-based diet is pretty tough.
It's really not. Yeah, that's the misperception about it. It's really not that hard. You just don't eat meat or dairy. So you just like you make all the meals that you generally like. You just don't put that stuff in it. You find supplements for it. And, you know, I was always a huge meat eater. Chicken all day long, because I thought that's what you had to do to get your muscles and be the bodybuilders. You know, you read all the magazines, chicken and broccoli, lean muscle gains. I did that for years, and I still never had muscles. And the funny thing, after I went plant-based, you know, I haven't had an injury, like a serious injury from training in 3 years since the day that I switched. And I used to get injuries all the time in the military. My shoulders, I had tendonitis in both my elbows to the point where I was like T-Rex some days. I couldn't even lift my arms up, and I don't have that anymore. And I understand it. It's pretty confronting for a lot of people to hear the vegan word and the plant-based word and not eating meat, not eating dairy. And they say they could never do it. And I thought that as well. I was one of those people. I just thought, you know, why vegetarian? Why would you not eat meat? Like, but I don't need it. And I work in conservation. You know, I went and shot a documentary in Africa where I was embedding with the anti-poaching units out there. And one of my buddies from the clearance diving teams was running that. He's running the International Anti-Poaching Foundation in Zimbabwe. And at dinner, he had a separate meal. And I was asking him about it. He said, I'm vegan, so that's like that's a plant-based meal. There's no meat or dairy in it. And I'm like, why would you do that? What's the thought process? And he said, well, I work in conservation. I'm out here in Africa. I'm trying to protect the rhinos and the giraffes and the elephants and all that stuff. And I was eating the animals. And I felt like a hypocrite. And that was what got me. That was the thought process. Okay, I'm protecting the animals. I'm trying to protect the ocean. I'm raising awareness about overfishing and commercial fishing and sharks. And yet I'm eating the animals. I grew up eating seafood. I love it. But I was contributing to the thing that I was trying to stop. That made me a hypocrite.
If you think about this subject, I mean, it is kind of nuts that all the other meat we eat, it comes from farming, like domesticated cattle, you know, animals that are raised specifically for that point. Like we don't, except for like hunters on their own volition, maybe in some parts of America. I mean, we don't go and kill these animals out in the wild for food, but we still do that with the ocean. We still do that with seafood, yeah. Just going out into the wild and harvesting en masse. All of the,
if it was just subsistence fishing like that, it wouldn't be a problem. The fish stocks would explode and there'd be bucket loads of it, but it's not. You know, everyone wants their fish and their oysters and whatever. And so we just don't have the supplies of that to support the population. And then when you go deeper into it, you start learning more about how little the animal agricultural industry cares about you and how much more they care about money. And, you know, you think about the food that those animals are eating, they're getting the cheapest, most genetically modified fungicide and pesticide laden food, plus getting hormones to make them bigger and stronger and fatter for more meat. And then the antibiotics they're given because of the poor conditions they're living in. And then we're eating that. So you're eating all the fungicides cycled through the animal, the pesticides, the genetically modified cheap-ass beans and corn, the hormones, and then put on top of that the fear, the anxiety, the pain, the adrenaline before they're killed. All of that, just in my mind, some people might have a different opinion, and that's cool, but in my mind, that is not a healthy food.
What about, I was just wondering, while you were recovering from your injuries, you weren't plant-based then, right?
No, not at all.
Because I do remember, you guys probably remember when Travis Barker from Blink-182 and DJ AM got into that plane crash. I remember Travis Barker writing that I believe he was a vegetarian or a vegan, but he said while they were doing the skin grafts on him, they said he had to eat meat at the time.
Oh, okay. I never heard anything about that.
Yeah, because I'm just wondering if at the time it would have been a problem, you know, in order to just with your injuries.
I don't see why. I think there's a lot of misconception about getting your required nutritional values without meat. If you do it properly and you know a bit about nutrition, it's really not that hard to get everything you need. Like, I've been doing it for 3 years and you know, I'm benching more than I've ever done before. I'm fit and strong and healthy. And, you know, it's nice to kind of break down some of those misperceptions about it and help people if they want to try it out, you know, give them a little guidance in it. You know, you know what? I feel good in my soul. You know, people will say, oh, you're still killing animals because all those fields that, you know, they have to farm to, you know, grow the food that you're eating. You know, you're still killing animals. I'm like, it's not about perfection. You know, it's about progression. You know? So I love it. I enjoy it. There's no death on my plate. I'd not taking in any of those chemicals, or I eat mostly organic when where I can, and it makes me feel good, and that works for me. So just getting across the point that you don't have to sacrifice to gain. It's all gain.
Interesting, man. It's funny because I think our audience is going to feel you don't fit the stereotype of a vegan, especially hearing this whole story. So it's cool that we've covered all that.
But I feel better than I ever have. So that's the measuring tool. You know, if you do something and you do it right and you feel good, then why would you not keep doing it?
Oh, I do have one more question I want to ask, and this is going to come across as kind of an ignorant question, I'm sure. But are you back to diving now?
I requalified in the Navy through 2010, 2011, 2012, and now I have to dive for Shark Week. So you know, I've done I did a dive off the coast of Western Australia, 110 feet. Outside of the cage with four male great white sharks. I just went on a trip to the Bahamas to dive with tiger sharks. I taught Ronda Rousey how to hand feed bull sharks at the start of this year for Shark Week. You know, I'm doing more diving than I was in the Navy now, and it's way more dangerous.
I wanted to ask you this kind of a strange question, but because of the changes your body went through and, you know, you're actually, you know, you had some limbs amputated, has that changed the dive tables for you at all?
I've never thought about that.
Yeah, I was just curious about that.
Well, I'm not dead, so.
You're okay, obviously.
I don't see why it would. It'd be no different to, you know, you don't change the dive tables for a 110-kilo person to a 210-kilo person.
True.
You know, so I don't think so. I don't think it'd come into play. I'm not as agile as I used to be, which is a pain in the ass. I've got a diving leg, and I use my weightlifting arm with a big steel hook on it so I can grab onto things and I can fend off any overly friendly sharks. But other than that, man, I love it under the water. You know, it's as close as you can get to being – totally encompassed in nature.
You were saying
about anything above surface.
You were saying you were free swimming outside the cage around great white sharks.
Yeah, I was diving. I was on scuba.
What's wrong with you?
I'm learning from the best. We're shooting a documentary. My buddy was the cameraman. He needed to get out and document the markings on these sharks, and he needed me to watch his back. And so, you know, he taught me everything I knew about great whites and diving with them, and so I trust him implicitly.
So it's not inherently dangerous to. I would think that the sharks would just make a beeline for you. I mean, we've all seen, you know, Shark Week where the shark comes up to the diver in the cage and is trying to get inside. You're like, holy shit!
Yeah, but that's because they're baiting them. You know,
with the chum.
It's a different mindset when you've got food in the water for them.
Yeah.
At the start of this year, we did another survival show where Shark Week blew up my boat, and I was with a British Special Forces guy, and we're off the coast of the Bahamas in the Atlantic, and they blew up our boat. We had to survive drifting through the Atlantic Ocean for 2 days, two nights, no food or water. And we had this school of oceanic white-tipped sharks around us the whole time, about 12 of them. And we were fending them off, but they were more curious than anything. And then they put the food in the water, and their mentality switched instantly into predatory mode. So it was the same sort of thing with the great whites. We didn't have any food with us. They were curious. I was probably 40 feet away from the cage, just kneeling down in with this seagrass all around me. This massive 14-foot great white shark came out of the murk, swimming directly at my face. And, you know, my heart did flutter a bit. But I had to remember, you know, don't act like food. They won't treat you like food. And so I stood my ground. I showed that I wasn't food. I was also a dominant force, and it swam directly up to me, turned a fraction, and then just swam past me. And you can see its big blue eye rotating and just looking at me and checking me out. And it just kept swimming past. It was incredible.
That's unreal.
Well, you know what's interesting is right next to me I have this book here from Brandon Webb, who's the one who made the connection for us, you know, his Mastering Fear book, which is all about overcoming fears. As you said, as we started the interview, your biggest fear was sharks. Yeah. I mean,
and then public speaking.
Really? Okay. Now, so I was going to say, what it's safe to say.
My public speaker.
I was just going to say, though, it's safe to say with what you're doing now with Shark Week, you've overcome that fear, at least on some level. I'm sure there's still the element of fear when you're doing what you do. At this point, do you have any other fears? Like, have you mastered all of your fears?
Well, there's something funny that happens to you when you come that close to death, confronting your worst nightmare, and you survive. You realize there's nothing left to be afraid of. So I moved into diving with sharks, and I started – my other greatest fear was public speaking. I was terrified. I quit information technology course halfway through at the six-month mark because I had to get up and talk in front of the class. at 19 years old, I was terrified of public speaking. And now I travel all across America doing motivational, inspirational, and keynote speaking. So – I don't see it as fear. My mind doesn't recognize it as fear anymore. It's more an excitement. It's a challenge to overcome instead of fear itself. Now, I'm not saying, I was catching crocodiles last year in Darwin for another show. I'm not saying that if I didn't have a crocodile running at me with its jaws gaping that I would not have fear. I would most definitely have fear, but it's about mitigating that fear and transferring it into something like now I see it as an opportunity to grow, embracing that fear, turning it into an adventure, turning it into a challenge, and allowing it to help me grow as a human being.
That's powerful, man. Well, the book, once again, is No Time for Fear, How a Shark Attack Survivor Beat the Odds. Paul's website is pauldegelder.com, at Paul DeGelder on Twitter, and at Paul DeGelder on Instagram, which you're very active on both. And apparently your wife is active on both because I've seen she's like a fit Instagram chick, so which is pretty cool.
She's not a wife quite yet.
Hello.
We saw you on his Instagram, so I'm sure people are going to follow you and then creep your wife. It's probably going to happen.
Most guys do. I would too. I creep her as well.
Well, this has been awesome, man. And even though it's like a ways off, I was going to say we got to have you back on when Shark Week comes around. I mean, that's summer, but I'm sure you're going to be involved in it again this year, right?
Yeah, I'm doing this parachute course. I got to get my A and B license to parachute out of a crashing plane into the South Pacific, into the world's second largest shark sanctuary, and survive for a couple of days and nights without food or water. So, I'll come back after we've done that one, and we'll have a chat about how insane that was.
That sounds great.
And I definitely want to hear more about like working with Ronda Rousey. That's pretty cool. I remember I think it was 2 years ago, maybe on Shark Week, they did something with Michael Phelps. I don't know if you got to meet him.
He raced a great white shark without racing a great white shark.
Yep. Did you get to meet him?
Pissed about that. No, he was on a different show. It was with some buddies of mine. But Ronda, you know what? A lot of people hated on Ronda and dumped on her after she got beat and then beat again. She is one incredible human being, I got to say. She's so sweet. She's so intelligent. She listened to everything we said. And she really was a great person to work with. And her husband, too, Travis Brown, is a really great guy. They've become quite good friends.
That's awesome, man. I mean, yeah, I think that's also part of, being a competitor the way she is that she's probably a very different person that you see inside the cage or during those interviews than in her personal life. I mean, I've even seen her attacked for things that I thought were, just her being candid. I remember she went on, I think it was like Ellen, after that loss, and she said she was, suicidal over it. And some people were saying, oh, you're a role model to little girls. You shouldn't be saying this. But I think there's nothing wrong with being candid. Oh, this is her whole life. So.
Absolute vulnerability and strength. And you don't get onto a show like that and then lie, do you? I know her as a person that would never make shit up. But being in the public light, sometimes some things come out that you wish you could take back. You can't always say exactly what you want when you're doing live TV or recorded, like back to back to back to back. Sometimes you fuck up. Not saying that was a fuck up, but it's not the easiest life being in the limelight all the time. And I have like the smallest little taste of it. I can't even imagine. I just finished working with a huge celebrity in the Bahamas, teaching him how to dive with tiger sharks. And he can't even, he literally hasn't walked down the street since, you know, 2001, because he can't. He can't go to the store. He can't, you know, go out with his kids to the movies. He can't do anything. So, you know, that's a very different and hard lifestyle to maintain. You got to give those guys credit.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on, Paul. We'll definitely do this again. Like I said, I'll keep your email so that during Shark Week, we could promote that out and talk about what you're up to.
Yeah, sounds good, lads.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really cool interview.
I can see you've got my favorite author in the background there.
Which one? Because we've got
you got the new book from Vince Flynn.
Oh yeah,
Red War. Yeah, we had the author who's taken up the mantle since
Kyle Mills.
Kyle Mills. That's it.
He was great.
Yeah, man. I've just finished the one before that. He's my favorite. I love that story.
Well, I'm sure they'll be glad to hear it. I mean, their team seems to listen to the podcast regularly, so that's high praise.
You can go listen to the...
I didn't know that book was released yet. I'm going to go get it today.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen back. We had Kyle Mills on. It was a great one. But yeah, man, appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Anytime. Thanks for having me, guys. Have a great day.
Good luck on Shark Week.
Yeah, I'm going to need it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Take care.
Man, so a lot of people... listen to the podcast, like we got that interview. We got that email from a listener who said he was really inspired by the Quinn Emerson interview. Like, I think this is a huge dose of inspiration. I mean, whatever you fear, whatever is bothering you, I mean, this guy, it just sounds like he got right back into the action after losing two limbs.
Yeah, couldn't stop, wouldn't stop. You know, that's one of those things where it obviously kept him going, it kept him sane, you know, had a goal to shoot for. It's maybe for some people anyway, it's those times when life slows down a little bit. That's when you kind of have to reconcile some of the things that have happened to you. And it sounds like he has. But man, that scares the shit out of me. Like, I would any day rather go back to war. Like, in combat, it's, you know, you're grown men, two soldiers show up on the battlefield, and it's just understood somebody's going home in a body bag, right? Like, it is what it is. But to, like, be underwater and get attacked by a shark, like, that's one of those things, like, a great white shark's coming right at you, or a bull shark in his case. Like, there is not a fucking thing you can really do. Like, if you're lucky, yeah, maybe you can, like, get an eye gouge or, like, grab its gills or something like that. But one of those big sharks, it's so big, like, you're just fucked.
Yeah.
That scares the shit out of me.
I think it would anybody. But I mean, it does seem like he's overcome all fears because of it. And I do get that. I mean, I've never had a near-death experience. But I'm sure after that, you say to yourself, what more could you do to me?
Well, I can at least partially understand, you know, him wanting to go back to work and getting so involved with the sharks. It's like one of those things where you have to confront it and kind of overcome it, or it's just going to be one of those things that's going to define your life.
Or, you know? I was going to say, which I just started, Carmen Gentile's book, where he goes right back to being embedded with an army.
Same story, you know? He got blinded in one eye, got his shit together, and went back to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It's like something, there's like two paths in front of you. Like, either you confront all that shit, or you just... you know, sit on the couch eating Doritos, getting fat, and wallowing in self-pity.
Or worst case scenario, be, you know, one of these, as we hear, 22 veterans a day, if that is the number.
Yeah. Addicted to opiates, you know, God forbid, you know, shooting yourself. I mean, it's like one of those, I feel like there's really like a hard decision that has to be made there. You know, go down one path or the other. And it is a decision. Even if you commit suicide, it's a bad decision.
Yeah.
But that's a decision you make. And you know what Carmine did, what Paul did, that they made decisions too. They decided to go down towards a more positive path and confront some of those fears and push past them.
And I bet he never would have thought, you know, like, he was a Navy diver, but he wasn't anyone ever heard of. Now he's going places, inspiring people. He put out a book. He's been on a television show and a series yearly with Shark Week. Like, he's a name that people know now. He's got a big following. I'm sure, like, the last thing he was thinking is, I'm going to become, like, a notable figure now. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know, but it is a remarkable story. So check out his website, pauldegelder.com. Wrapping things up here, be sure to check out Crate Club. We have different tiers of membership depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. Scott Whitner from the Loadout Room and the guys are currently working on bringing you 100% custom products in 2019. Everything from sunglass cases to EDC bags and other manly products. It's a club for men, by men. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. Also, as a reminder for those listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel. That's at specopschannel.com, and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership, only $4.99 a month. That's specopschannel.com. Sign up today. And the last thing I'm mentioning here that you just heard about in the two most recent episodes is the NewsRep Financial Report, which has exclusive information that you can act on today to secure a brighter future for tomorrow. The NewsRep Financial Report can help you discover new investment strategies in the defense sector. Defense industry stocks can be a lucrative investment if you buy at the right time. Our team of foreign policy, security, and military experts provide real-time intelligence for stocks based on global trends that affect financial markets in the national defense industry. By subscribing now, you'll get exclusive access to our industry expertise. The NewsRep Financial Newsletter Advantage. Our team offers unmatched defense industry familiarity and expertise, unbiased knowledge of geopolitical trends, full access to NewsRep's foreign policy, security, and financial intelligence platform, and access to our team of experts and analysts. Just go to the FinRep tab at the top of the NewsRep.com to sign up. That's FinRep on the NewsRep.com. And man, this has been a great episode. I learned a lot from it. I feel inspired. I will not become a vegan anytime soon, but, you know, I actually like hearing about all this stuff. I've told you before that, like, I recently, narrated a raw vegan audiobook. So it's just, I don't know. It's interesting to me hearing about different people's diets and lifestyles. But I do agree with them. If it's something that works for you, I'm all for that. I'm very laissez-faire with that. And yes, the thing that Donald Trump tweeted, I saw that, which he retweeted from some website, right? Do you want to describe it?
It's like a campaign poster kind of deal for Elizabeth Warren. And it says Warren. And then below it, it says 1/2020.
Yeah. Making a reference to her Native American heritage.
Okay, that's fucking funny.
It is. It's funny that he tweeted it out, really. I mean, you're the president, but, you know, I said it before on my Twitter feed with her announcing, you know, an exploratory committee. I really feel she stands no chance. I don't think she's appealing to the mainstream average American.
No. The Democrats are dumb. They're making every mistake there is to make. You know, they could run Joe Biden and maybe win. But they're not going to do it because he's an old white guy. So they're going to want to run somebody who's unelectable and basically hand this thing to Donald. I think that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's very likely. Of other names I'm hearing, though, I think someone, if I'm being objective here, I think someone like Cory Booker would be more appealing than Liz Warren. I just think Liz Warren, between her radical views, but also... just even her speaking style and things like that, that people don't take into account on when we're talking, but people forget that the public votes based on really small things sometimes, just how this person looks. And, you know, I don't find her to be electable, but I agree with you. I think Trump is going to win again. I think we're going to see Trump win in 2020. And now that it's 2019, like, we're gearing up for what's going to be probably a heated Democrat primary.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, we're wrapping this up. You're going to record your news segment, which people can check out at thenewsrep.com.
Oh, boy.
Next episode, we have Alex Hollings coming back on.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And then I'm excited for 2 weeks from now, Ed Derrick coming back on.
Yeah, that's going to be cool. He has his photography book coming out soon.
Yep.
Pictures he took. We'll talk to him about it, but I believe there were most or all of them taken in Afghanistan.
And you guys heard me talk about on a recent episode the whole Kratom thing and that documentary Leap of Faith, and that I saw that guy, Peter Guidry, who runs a veterans group and is a firm believer in Kratom for post-traumatic stress. So we're going to have him on. Excited for that as well. Great shows coming on in 2019, and I am still trying to get Dennis Rodman on the podcast.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.